from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, Israel's housing ministry announced plans to construct 565 new homes for Jewish settlers in the West Bank. The news came just after the Israeli cabinet gave the go-ahead for the country's lengthening security fence to cut deep into Palestinian territory to protect Israeli outposts. The vast majority of Israelis traumatized by Palestinian terror strikes want the fence. A smaller number want the settlements, but both new steps appear at odds with Washington calls for and maybe with the very possibility of a two-state solution. So where is this headed? Tonight on Point, the fence, the settlements, and the future of Israel. We begin in Jerusalem with today's developments. Harvey Morris is Jerusalem bureau chief for the Financial Times. I asked him if the decision on the security fence or wall means it will eventually cut deep into the West Bank.
I think they've pretty much decided to build the wall. The only question mark now is over the timetable. They've decided to put the wall, or fence as it is in some cases, around some of the bigger settlements inside the West Bank. But they're going to delay a decision on whether they actually fill in the gaps between the various sections for another 6 or 8 months. And this is obviously because they're concerned about the U.S. reaction to the plan.
Is the presumption there at this point then, Harvey, that in fact the wall or fence will be completed? It will eventually hook up with this piece that's deeper inside the West Bank. It's just a matter of time?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the case. I mean, the plan calls for the whole wall to be completed at some stage. And the government has said, when we get to the contentious bits, then we'll discuss it with the Americans again.
How much of the West Bank that had been envisioned as being part of a potential future Palestinian state will now be sealed off behind the fence or the wall, Harvey?
People talk about 10%, but that's 10% in the west of the West Bank. Now, there are also other plans being discussed to run a wall down the eastern side of the West Bank, down the Jordan Valley, which would carve off a lot more territory, which is lightly populated by Palestinians, but which has a lot of Jewish settlements in it. So it's all sort of moving towards the solution which everyone believes Ariel Sharon has in mind, to have a state on offer which only includes 42% of the West Bank.
That is a state on offer to the Palestinians?
Well, it's not on offer at the moment. But should it get to that point, he would maybe be prepared to negotiate a state which would include the Gaza Strip plus 42% of the West Bank. Now, the question there is, would it be accepted and would it be viable if it were to be created?
Another development, Israel announcing that it will construct 565 new homes in three Jewish settlements in the West Bank. Harvey Morris, my understanding was that under the roadmap, which perhaps is dead and irrelevant now anyway, but that new settlement construction was to be out of bounds.
Well, indeed. I mean, the Israeli argument is that in view of the fact that they consider that the Palestinians have done insufficient or indeed nothing to crack down on terrorist groups, which is also part of the roadmap,
yes,
that their hands are not tied on the matter of settlement.
So hundreds more will go up. How does all this relate to the relationship between Israel and the Bush administration right now, Harvey? Are they in concert on this or are they in conflict?
Well, I don't think they can be said to be in conflict because they had fairly high-level talks in Washington recently about this whole issue of whether what was being expended on the settlements and the wall would be deducted from the loan guarantees. And as we know, the U.S. administration is still considering its position there, although it certainly opposes the wall. But we haven't heard very strident language from Washington about these latest developments. So it does seem as if there's been some sort of understanding reached before these decisions have been made.
So there's a $9 billion loan guarantee package from the U.S. to Israel, and the official word from Washington is that they might still withhold part of that if they decide they don't approve of what's going on with the wall.
That's as we stand now, yeah, although no decision has been made as to how much may be deducted. Yeah, I don't know if you recall, I mean, there was a great argument about loan guarantees back in 91 after the Kuwait War, and eventually Washington granted a loan guarantee package of $10 billion, which was paid over between 1993 and 1997. Now, of that $10 billion, I think somewhat less than half a billion was eventually withheld as a result of settlement activity.
Harvey, in total then, with the wall being extended, with more settlements going up, but particularly the wall, how is that being perceived in Israel? Is this the minimum necessary to assure Israeli security after so many terrorist attacks? Or is this an expression of a kind of greater Israel that's expanding into the West Bank, or is it both?
Well, the people who really believe in greater Israel, who are the hardline settlers, of course, have never approved of the wall because they say if you stick up a wall, it could end up being a border, and we have not renounced our right to settle anywhere in the West Bank. Ironically, this whole idea of a wall or a fence came from the left, who felt that if you ran a wall down the border with the West Bank, it would indeed deter suicide bombers. Ariel Sharon and the right wing were never very keen about the idea. They've come to embrace it, mainly because the majority of Israelis think it's a good idea, because, you know, it's a security thing. So now the left are less keen on it, and the right have embraced it as long as they're allowed to keep these large settlements on the Israeli side.
And so far, that looks like it's where things are headed. Harvey Morris, thanks very much for joining us.
Not at all. Pleasure.
Harvey Morris is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He spoke with me from Jerusalem. What's your reaction to more fence and more settlement housing on the West Bank? Are these steps toward peace and security or something else? Does Israel really have a choice? And if so, what is it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Jerusalem is Dori Gold. He is an advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations. He's author of Hatred's Kingdom, How Saudi Arabia Supports the New Global Terrorism. Good evening. Very late there. And welcome back to On Point, Dori Gold.
Oh, good evening or good morning, depending on where you are.
Yeah, good morning there. Thanks so much for being with us. I know it's late. Joining us tonight from Washington is Robert Malley, Middle East Program Director for the International Crisis Group, a think tank that addresses policy issues around the world. He was an advisor to President Clinton on Israeli-Palestinian affairs. Good evening and welcome, Robert Malley.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
So, Dori Gold, more decisions today in Israel, decisions that will extend the security fence going up, this time rather deep in the West Bank, not connected to the rest of it, but $100 million worth of fence, I guess, on the other side of the settlement of Ariel, and more housing units going up. The phrase facts on the ground has often been used. What will these facts on the ground represent in terms of the long-term Israeli-Palestinian relationship, Dori Gold?
Well, let's start with one fundamental. Israel did not want to build this wall or this fence, as we call it, because it really isn't just concrete. It's a whole system of fences.
Some places a wall, some places a fence. We understand.
Right. But the main thing is Israel had no interest in building this. You know, William Safire appropriately called this Arafat's barrier for a very good reason in the New York Times the other day. And the reason is because the entire security structure of the Oslo agreements that were erected originally back in 1993 with Yasser Arafat, was that the Palestinians would take responsibility, security responsibility, mm-hmm. for the areas under their jurisdiction. Unfortunately, Arafat failed in the assignment. He repeatedly failed several prime ministers. And now we've gotten to a point where we're 10 years after Oslo was signed. We've lost nearly 1,000 Israeli lives. And we have to take measures now to protect our citizens. The areas under his control were infiltrated by large groups like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and finally his own Tanzim and Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigades. These people were initiating repeated suicide bombings in the heart of our cities, in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv, in Ashkelon, in Haifa, and Israel has every right in the world now to defend itself, and it has chosen a route for this wall which will provide the optimal defense for the citizens of Israel.
Robert Malley, Israel needs to defend itself, but what are the further implications of the wall? Does it make a peace settlement impossible?
Well, you know, in a way, this is the first barrier I could recall that's actually going to prevent separation. Because with a barrier like this, and I certainly understand the security concerns that Dori Gold just mentioned, and I wouldn't want anyone nobody should think that this is an easy situation for Israelis living there.
But we've all read the news. We've all seen the pictures. It's been terrible.
Exactly. But building the wall this way, combined with the settlement expansion, I think, as I said, is going to make separation between two states, which everyone or most people recognize is the only way that Israelis and Palestinians are going to be able to live in peace, impossible.
Making separation impossible because the wall winds so deeply into the West Bank, because the settlements are clearly in that territory?
Because the greater the number of settlers living in the West Bank, the more the wall becomes entrenched in West Bank territory, the harder it's going to be for any Israeli government to say, now we're going to simply move all the settlers, destroy the wall, change all the facts on the ground that we've created over the years. And therefore, and I'm hearing this more and more from Palestinians, they're saying if the state we're going to have is one that is going to be further diminished as a result of the settlements, as a result of the wall, who wants a two-state solution? We're going to go for a one-state solution, one man, one vote. I'm sure that's not Dory Gold's vision of the future of Israel. It certainly is inconsistent with the dream, the Zionist dream of building a Jewish state in the Middle East. And I think that certainly from a Palestinian point of view, the wall is a disaster. I think the whole phenomenon of the wall and the settlements are also a disaster for Israel in the long run. And that's where I think people should stop and think, where are we headed and is there not another way? And despite the fact that this is coming from a security impulse, there's now a political agenda that's being added to it, which is the one that was referred to earlier of territorial expansion. And in any event, it's going in the wrong direction, both for the Palestinians and for the Israelis.
Dory Gold, is this a short-term solution to a terrible security problem and a long-term nightmare for the very idea of a Jewish state? If you end up with one great big population under one great big umbrella, in effect, and Jews are outnumbered by Palestinians?
Well, let's be very clear about something here. The wall is being built as a security barrier to provide an immediate solution to a problem. Right now, in many parts of Israel and the West Bank, a Palestinian can leave the city of Jenin in a small car filled with dynamite, drive into Netanya, and kill 30 Israelis, and nothing stops him.
Mm-hmm.
That is simply untenable. And the people of Israel have a right to prevent that from occurring. You would want it in Boston or in New York or anyplace else to prevent that kind of ease of mass murder. Now, let's go beyond the immediate term and look at the long term that Rob Malley is talking about as well. Those who object to the wall on political terms and tell us to figure out how to protect our people some other way,
right,
are concerned that the wall may evolve into a political border 2 years, 5 years, whatever. Now, here's the issue. Let's say the wall does add territory to Israel in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that that scenario occurs. In any case, UN Security Council Resolution 242, which has been the basis of the peace process from day one, never suggested that Israel was going to pull back to the 1967 lines. It talked about a withdrawal from territories, not the territories, and everybody who's studied Middle East 101 knows that.
But clearly there's been an awful lot of conversation that did have something like that presumption at the heart of it with the Palestinians and with Washington.
Right now, we, you know, whatever negotiations existed in the past that failed in the last Clinton year in office does not bind the state of Israel. Failed negotiating records can't be taken out and used to bind a present Israeli government.
You think you can turn to the Palestinians, as we heard from the Financial Times reporter, and say 42% of the West Bank is what you'll have now? Will that possibly work?
What will be the ultimate percentages? But what's clear is this. 242 never required a full withdrawal from Israel if we talk about political borders in the future. And number two, almost every American Secretary of State, certainly since the Reagan administration, but even before, spoke about the fact that Israel has a right to defensible borders, secure borders for Israel. George Shultz said Israel will never withdraw to the 67 lines. This is U.S. policy, not just Israeli policy. President Bush, at the Madrid Peace Conference, the current President Bush's father, spoke about the fact that ultimately there will be a territorial compromise in the West Bank Gaza Strip.
Sounds like it's going to have to be a big one. Dory Gold, please stand by. Robert Malley, Jack Beatty will come to you momentarily. We're talking tonight about the fence, the settlers, and the future of Israel. You can join the conversation. What's your reaction to the news of more fence and more West Bank settlement? Are these steps toward more peace and security or something else? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the fence, the settlers, and the future of Israel. My guests are Dori Gold. He's advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations. He joins us tonight from Jerusalem. And from Washington, Robert Malley, Middle East Program Director for the International Crisis Group and an advisor to President Clinton on Israeli-Palestinian affairs. Jack Beatty is with us as well. You can join the conversation. Does Israel have a choice here? And what is it in the absence of peace with the Palestinians? Where is Sharon? Where are the wall and the settlements leading Israel? And does Palestinian terrorism forfeit Palestinian claims on territory, on sovereignty, or does it make the need for a Palestinian state even more urgent? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, you've been listening to all this. Where does your mind go? We see wave after wave of development here, failure upon failure to get security, to get peace, to get talks really going, and facts on the ground growing.
Yes, and if you can, if we can back up from this a minute, we can and ask, what are America's interests here in this country, Israel? Well, over my lifetime, billions, scores of billions of dollars have gone to fund Israel. If I had been in Congress, I would have voted for that. But we have to ask, what have we got for those billions? Well, one thing we've got is the enmity of the entire Muslim world, not for just that reason alone, but as the study on the front page of the New York Times yesterday said, our partiality toward Israel is a large part of that estrangement. Now, why does that matter? Because our economic interests lie with the Arab states in the Middle East. That's just a fact. Jobs, jobs, jobs. That was the rationale for Gulf War I, and I think it's also the rationale for Gulf War II. We need the oil. Well, then we say, have we got a strategic partner in Israel? I don't think so. We have a, it looks more like a strategic liability. In 1973, we nearly went to nuclear, we went into nuclear alert because of an Israeli war. In Gulf War I, our main effort was to keep Israel out. In Gulf War II, keep Israel out. So we've had two wars in the region, and the strategic asset has not, has been something we're more like a liability. So then the question is, why? Why are we, what's in it for America? Well, one reason is domestic politics. And Harry Truman, I think when he recognized Israel, put that very well. He said, I have to answer to hundreds of thousands who are anxious for the success of Zionism. I do not have hundreds of thousands of Arabs among my constituents. That's one reason. But the other reason is a moral imperative. Christendom, Western civilization, owes it to the Jewish people that they should survive, that they should have, that never again should they be threatened with genocide, and that they should have their homeland. That's a moral commitment. But our moral, so if it's a moral commitment, when a government of Israel acts to see in a way that seems to just be against our interest, it's throwing back at us. Throwing in our face that moral commitment, and it's almost as if it's a burden on Israel, a unique and heavy burden. But there it is; it has to act in such a way not to forfeit or dilute what I think is a substantially, when you get to it, a moral commitment to Israel's survival. But, and when this government does things, the UN report this week spoke of it, that said that the wall strongly suggests Israel is determined to create facts on the ground amounting to de facto annexation. Well, when they do things like that, it weakens, it dilutes. We have to ask, what can we expect for our aid to that country?
Robert Malley, the arguments around this subject are always so hot and difficult. I mean, Jack Beatty here raises issues of morality around the wall. On the other hand, Dori Gold points out Israel has a responsibility to try and protect its citizens from slaughter. So where do things lie here? Where's the fundamental interest of Israel, the Palestinians, the United States? Is there an intersection you can point to?
There is an intersection, but I want to come back to something that Dori Gold said, is when he's describing the fact that the territory is basically up for compromise and that the borders of 67 are not sacrosanct. The fact is, the negotiations between the two sides, to which the United States was a party during that years past, mm-hmm. was premised on the fact that the borders would be roughly 67 with a land swap, a land exchange, to take into account Israel's demographic needs and its security needs. But this is, we're not talking about Israel annexing 20%, 30% of the West Bank. People who negotiated this, and the vast majority of Israelis and Palestinians would agree, are talking about somewhere between maybe 5%, maybe 4%, maybe 6%, in that range. What we're seeing today with the settlements and with the wall are flying in the face of what everyone believes a fair compromise would be. And fair enough, in the end of the day, Israel may say these are our security needs, but if it doesn't have a deal on the table that the other side's going to accept, where does it leave it? Because if it is a one-state solution, if you can't get partition on grounds that the Palestinians would accept, then Israel is going to be forced to rule over what will ultimately become an Arab majority, and that, as I said earlier, is not something that's to Israel's in Israel's interest, not in the Palestinians' interest, not in the U.S. interest, certainly not, because if we then back Israel, as was just said, we're viewed even more negative light in the Arab world, and if we don't, we lose a strategic partner, an ally, who we've been committed to. So I think these issues we're talking about land, we can't talk about them in the abstract.
But so what's your answer then to Dory Gold pointing at the imminent and immediate threat to Israeli lives of attack? He says we've got to put a fence up. There's no other way to stop that carload of dynamite.
Two things. Number one, you certainly don't have to continue expanding settlements. Settlements are increasing Israel's vulnerability because, first of all, because they're provoking more attacks. Second of all, because the settlements themselves are vulnerable. So that argument certainly doesn't apply to the settlements, and we're seeing, as we saw today, settlement expansion, and part of the problem with the fence is that it's encroaching into area that every U.S. government, including the most sympathetic to Israel, President Clinton, President Bush, have said that they oppose the settlement expansion, and this one has said is it opposes the encroachment of the wall into Palestinian West Bank territory. Mm. So it's fair enough to say protect Israel and Israeli citizens. But you first have to recognize the fact that settlements are being built illegally. Now, even then, a wall along the 1967 line plus protection for the settlements could be done without building a wall that encroaches deep into Palestinian territory. There are ways to do it. But, you know, frankly, at the end of the day, there will always be a security problem for Israel, and there will always be a territorial problem for the Palestinians until we resolve the problem once and for all. And I truly think for both sides, that's the only solution, because we're going to continue to have settlement expansion and we're going to continue to have violence on the Palestinian side until the day comes when we could resolve the problem comprehensively and once and for all.
Dory Gold, in Jerusalem, there's a lot on the table here. Let me go first, if I may, and get your response to Jack Beatty's suggestion that there may be a divergence of interests emerging here between the United States and Israel or the Sharon government. How do you see that?
Well, I don't think so. I think Israel has been seeking all along to agree to almost every American peace plan that's been on the table. Since we faced this uprising, we agreed to the Mitchell Commission report. We agreed to the Tenet proposals. We agreed to General Zinni's proposals on the ground. We agreed also to the roadmap. We had some reservations, but we began to implement our side until we saw that the Palestinians didn't even lift a finger. So I think his characterization reflects his views. He can have them. But I don't think it's close to reality. The main thing is this. We are putting the wall in a place that's optimal for the defense of Israel. I'll give you another example. Everyone's talking about the city of Ariel.
Mm-hmm.
How about Ben-Gurion Airport, our main international airport?
Yep.
We are not going to leave the defense perimeter of that airport exposed. Right now, if we do not put the fence in place, we could have Palestinian, Hamas, other organizations with shoulder-fired missiles that are proliferating all over the Middle East, sitting on a West Bank hill, taking down an Al-Al aircraft. So part of our defensible borders, which we're entitled to, is to put the fence in a position that will make that virtually impossible to conduct.
So the wall will be a real threat
mm. all over the Middle East with SA-7s and Stingers that are in Iraq.
No, we've got it. We've seen the stores that have been unearthed here and there. So the wall will go up where the wall goes up for defense. But what about then this issue, which Robert Malley raises and others have raised, of the ultimate Arab majority that's foreseeable in this territory? You know very well, New York Times columnist Tom Friedman has written that if there is no separation, that by 2010, that's not very long from now, there'll be more Palestinians than Jews living in Israel and the occupied territories. He writes that at that point, Israel will have three options. They can control the whole area by what he calls apartheid. They can control it by expelling Palestinians, or they will grant Palestinians the right to vote, and it will no longer be a Jewish state. Whichever way it goes, he writes, it will mean the end of Israel as a Jewish democracy. Surely that has to factor in awfully large here as well.
Well, these guys are taking out very tough weapons to argue with Israel on this issue that I think are really inappropriate. I think what we have to look at is what the wall actually does. The wall, first of all, stabilizes the situation. You can't have a negotiation if you have Israelis getting killed every other week by suicide bombing. Mm. That's going to be very difficult for Palestinian groups to continue to do if we have the wall in place. So first of all, we get stabilization. Second of all, we will also have an ability to check Palestinians who want to work in Israeli cities before they come in to take those jobs. So therefore, we could even have income being pumped into the Palestinians until investment and external organizations begin to help rebuild the Palestinian economy in a serious way, which Israel has an interest in occurring. Once we're stabilized, once the economies begin to grow, then we could also have a better chance of a new Palestinian leadership rising who will negotiate a settlement. The wall is not a wall. It's a fence. And where it's looser, where it's easier, I'm sure Israel will be able to adjust the fence either way. Ultimately, what will occur is Palestinian contiguity from the north of the West Bank to the south of the West Bank will not be interrupted. And therefore, will the Palestinians get everything they want? No. But what we will have in the end is a Palestinian self-governing entity, even a Palestinian state, and defensible borders for Israel. So that, to me, does not sound like Israel being demographically overwhelmed.
So there's a picture of ultimate flexibility and stabilization in the interim. I want to turn to our callers. Neil's calling from Swampscott, Massachusetts. Hi, Neil. You're on the air.
Hi. Glad to be on again.
Good to have you.
First of all, I wanted to say something, and maybe someone had a response to it. And my comment is, it's about the writing on the fence, and the gate is closing. And the fence is the literal fence. The gate is the metaphorical gate on the Palestinians feeling that their opportunities are closing down upon them.
Is this a good thing or a bad thing, Neil?
I think it's very good, and I'll explain why. First of all, I've been a consistent and vocal proponent of a two-state solution for 30 years. I think the fence is a critical component in enabling that. The problem is that the situation was stuck, and it needed something to yank it loose. Two things have happened to yank it loose. 9/11 put terrorism out of vogue. That was one very important thing, and Iraq and Saddam no longer supporting.
But it didn't go out of vogue in Israel, that's for sure. There's been plenty.
No, but in the rest of the world, it is less in vogue than it used to be. Let's put it that way.
Well, in some of the rest of the world, in other parts of the rest of the world, it's worse than it used to be.
There are problems, but...
It's not popular. I'll grant you that.
It's not as popular, I think, as it used to be. But the other point is that getting the Palestinian public, who I still contend are the leading democracy public in the Arab world.
Mm-hmm. Okay? You mean the most potential to be a democratic body?
No, also, they want something. It happens. They make things happen
okay.
as a public.
Okay.
Today they make things happen.
They're engaged. I got it.
Voting,
I got
it.
Right? So?
Arafat wasn't elected, but they do support him. Okay. So anyway, so something had to jar it loose. Now, the fence is jarring it loose because here's this fence coming around, blocking them in, reducing their options, reducing their negotiation position, the additional settlers there. There were only small numbers years ago.
So you see it as raising the leverage to bring Palestinians to a negotiating table.
Very much so.
Neil, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Robert Malley, how do you interpret that?
Well, if only that were the case, but I think evidence points in the complete opposite direction. Everything that's happened over the last few years has just deepened feelings on both sides, feelings of suspicion, hatred, and enmity. I think both sides are to blame for that. Certainly Palestinian acts of violence, suicide terror is to blame for that. And the continuation of Israel's territorial expansion, which started, by the way, not only with Palestinian terrorism, it began with Oslo. I mean, or it had begun before, and it accelerated under Oslo. So, again, there's enough blame to go around during all this period. But one thing we learned, neither side gives in to pressure. Neither side, Israelis are not going to react because out of fear of terrorist attacks. They're not going to make more concessions. And the Palestinians are not going to kneel and bend over because... the wall is being built. On the contrary.
You don't think they'll see a gate closing on a window, a period of opportunity?
They are definitely seeing a gate closing, but what you're hearing from more and more of them is if the gate's closing on a two-state solution, fine, we'll take a one-state solution. It was the original view of Arafat's group, a one-state solution, a binational secular state for Jews and Arabs.
But they can't really take a one-state solution, can they? I mean, if Israel doesn't agree to it, how do they take it?
Over time, the notion is if you're going to have a majority of Arabs, the position will be simply unsustainable to have an apartheid state, a minority ruling over a majority. So some Palestinians, and I hear it more and more, believe genuinely that over time, 10, 20, 30 years, it will simply become impossible for a minority Jewish population to govern a majority Arab population, and the notion of expulsion will simply be unacceptable.
But Dory Gold says, get real, we can readjust these boundaries, we can have a contiguous north-south West Bank population of Palestinians. Even if we can't do it today, it can be done.
It's the combination of the wall and the settlement expansion. I still think it can be done. I don't think that the window has shut yet. But what I'm hearing from many Palestinians is as time goes by, they lose faith in a two-state solution. And at some point, Israel is going to have to negotiate with someone. If there's nobody at the other end of the table who's prepared to take a two-state solution, who are they going to make that deal with?
Lee's calling from Wrentham, Massachusetts. Hi, Lee. You're on the air.
Yes. Well, this is depressing. I think Israel doesn't want peace. I think what they really want is territory, and I think they would much rather duke it out with Hamas than negotiate with the Palestinian Authority. And this idea of perpetual war, I think it just fits into the strategy.
But duking it out has hardly been any fun, and a lot of people have died. I mean,
I think the Israelis have decided that apparently that is acceptable.
Okay,
it goes Hamas. I mean, it's a very bad situation.
We've got the perspective, Dory Gold. How do you respond to that?
Well, let me say two things. First of all, I think that's basically a baseless charge. I think Israel, we're a very small country. Everybody knows everybody who gets killed. We're all going to funerals today. You know, my good friend David Applebaum, the doctor who was killed in Jerusalem, used to take care of me, my family. We all knew him well. He was the leading Israeli doctor in emergency room care. He was briefing Americans on how to do emergency room.
The bloodletting's been terrible, but there are elements within Israeli society who are very open about wanting territorial expansion.
Well, I wouldn't use the word territorial expansion. These are disputed territories. There's Resolution 242, and we have a right to defensible borders. And that is what we're talking about. We're not talking about preventing the Palestinians from having contiguity north and south. And I'd like to add one other thing.
Okay.
The city of Ariel that we've been talking about
yes.
in the news, where Israel has a barrier going around it, even under the Clinton plan, there was a notion that these settlement blocks would be incorporated into Israel.
Right.
Of course, there was a land swap idea put forward, which was not in 242 and which was new, and the Palestinians didn't accept it in any case. So even under the most conciliatory plans put on the table by our former Prime Minister Barak, approved by President Clinton, there was a notion that these settlements would be retained by Israel. Not all of them, but these large ones like Maale Adumim next to Jerusalem and Ariel in Samaria. So I don't think we're talking about a fact that if we put up a wall and we try to find optimal protection for the people of Israel from suicide bombing, that we've precluded a contiguous and viable Palestinian state from arising. And to say the people of Israel have to suspend their right of defense just because of bad PR, it doesn't make sense.
I don't hear anybody saying that. It'd be tough to do. Dory Gold, Robert Malley, Jack Beatty, stand by. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about the fence, the settlers, and the future of Israel. You can join the conversation should the U.S. withhold loan guarantees to impose a position on Israel. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the fence, the settlers, and the future of Israel. We're joined by Dory Gold, advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, joining us from Jerusalem. From Washington, Robert Malley, Middle East Program Director for the International Crisis Group and an advisor to President Clinton on Israeli-Palestinian affairs. Our own Jack Beatty is with us. You can join as well. Washington has opposed more settlement and deep incursions by the security fence. Are the U.S. and Israel having an honest conversation here? Should Washington embrace the Sharon approach? And what future do you see emerging for Israel, emerging for the Palestinians? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Isaiah is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Isaiah. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Basically, just a quick statement and then and ask a question, if I could. I think that Israel is negotiating in good faith consistently for the last 10 years. They've even prior to that, they've constantly reached out their hand to the Arab nations around them, and they've tried to make peace with them, and they've constantly been either attacked or, as with in the Oslo Accords, which was basically nothing more. The day that they signed the Oslo Accords and they signed Arafat, he went on top of his headquarters and said that his capital would be Jerusalem, which was completely the opposite of what he should have done in accordance with the Oslo Accords.
So where should things go now, Isaiah?
Well, I personally think that a two-state solution is absolutely cannot happen. I know people dismiss that, but we're talking about realism here. They have constantly been attacked for the last 10 years.
What's the alternative?
I think permanent annexation of, of Judea and Samaria. And
but that you mean you mean the West Bank? You mean the occupied territory there?
Well, I don't think they're occupied.
Okay,
I know.
But you're saying all the territory right on through where the mass of Palestinians live in, and what would the status of Palestinians be in such an annexed territory?
Well, I think if you go just a few miles to the east, you're in basically Palestinian territory anyway. You're in Jordan, which is primarily Palestinian as it is right now.
So they you're arguing to expel whatever the number is, millions of Palestinians, just push them across the border, expulsion?
I do think that's the final solution. It's the only solution that will work, I think. I know that people attack that. It's just like when you're saying occupied territories. It's not occupied. I believe that Judea and Samaria has always been Israel's. And if anybody was being occupied, it was Israel by the Arabs.
Isaiah, we've got it loud and clear. Robert Malley, what do you make of this perspective? How widespread is it?
Well, I don't think it's particularly widespread, and I certainly don't think that it's a viable solution or a moral solution. And I think it's best to think about viable and moral solutions for all sides. I think right now, again, most Israelis and most Palestinians who are polled on this question, the vast majority of the international community has basic agreement on the outlines of a fair and viable solution, a two-state solution. And rather than waste time and blood and all this energy on this conflict, it would be far better for the United States to put forward this plan with backing from the international community and to put it directly to the people of Israel and the Palestinian people, because they're the ones who today are suffering, and it's in their name that people are waging the struggle. And I'd be prepared to wager that at the end of the day they would go for a solution whose outline was put forward 2 and 3 years ago, rather than for the bloodbath.
You mean a kind of popular referendum on each side?
I think ultimately what the United States ought to do would be to put forward with a broad coalition of other countries a plan that it wouldn't seek to impose on either side, but would ask the leaderships of both sides to submit to their people. How could they could say no to the United States? How could they say no to the request that their people decide what a fair solution is and whether the solution that the United States, Israel's long-term strategic ally, and the most powerful country in the world is putting to both sides as a fair solution? Let the leaders of the Palestinians and Israelis say no to the U.S., and let's see what happens then to their standing with their own people.
Jack Beatty, can you see Washington stepping in with that kind of vigor? And do you think it would be effective if they did?
I don't think that's on. I mean, I think that there just isn't the political support for that. Mr. Bush has been active, and I think that his statement last year and about the Palestinian state and his commitment to the roadmap, this is important. But the trouble is that it's very hard to make progress on these things in an election year, and I suspect that may be one reason the White House is pulling back a little on its criticism. But you know, I just wanted to return to a point made earlier.
Yes.
Those terrible alternatives that Tom Friedman was talking about. You can be a Zionist homeland, or you can be a democracy if in the situation of the one state solution. Terrible choice to have to make. But there is another choice, and that may even be what the facts on the ground are heading toward, and that is unilateral withdrawal from the West Bank, including the settlements, except for those most around Jerusalem.
What's the evidence that things are heading in that direction, Jack?
Well, you've got a wall, and you've got a desperate security situation in Israel. Now, how long will this go on? I mean, I hope it doesn't go on another day.
Oh, you mean but complete if it goes on, the wall and then pull Israeli troops behind it?
That's exactly right. And have unilateral withdrawal, and Conor Cruz O'Brien calls it Fortress Israel. He thinks that's the way these things are going. That's the direction of things, that you can't expect the Israelis to forever leave themselves exposed to terrorism. And on the other hand, if you can't do business with the Palestinians, then you just pull your settlements in and say, all right, the West Bank is yours, but you're not coming in here.
Dory Gold, is that where we're headed?
Well, I think we are moving from the kind of conflict resolution we saw attempted at the end of the Clinton administration with plans that weren't acceptable to either party to what I would call conflict management, and that is sort of cooling down the conflict with the wall so that we can move to a better day. Now, everybody speaks with tremendous conviction how they know what the ultimate political relationships in the area are going to look like. Mm. I don't think anybody has any idea. You know, if you look at half the conflicts around the world, look at Bosnia. Do you know what Bosnia is going to look like in 20 years? Do you know what Kosovo is going to look like in 20 years? Do you know what Cyprus is going to look like in 20 years? Nobody knows.
Let alone
there
Israel.
There are fundamental facts. Israel will need defensible borders. The Palestinians will need to have their own political entity. And maybe in the future, Jordan can come into the mix, although at present it doesn't look very likely.
Robert Malley, how about it? Is this the pragmatic future? Fortress Israel? Can it work? This doesn't even require negotiation. You just put the wall up and say, that's it. Don't cross. Done.
Well, it depends where they withdraw to. If they withdraw to the lines that Palestinians will deem acceptable, are they going to leave the Jordan Valley before having security agreements with the Palestinians about what kind of weapons they could have, about what kind of alliances they could have? You know, this is a conflict that involves two parties, and one party is not going to solve it alone. I think if Dora Gold were negotiating by himself, we'd get a solution tomorrow. It's not where we are. We have two sides that have very strong interests, and both sides are going to have to make compromises. They'll have to be defensible borders, but they'll also have to be a viable, not only contiguous, a viable sovereign Palestinian state. And withdrawing unilaterally will only get you so far, because I cannot imagine that Israel will withdraw to borders that the Palestinians will deem acceptable, and I don't think that they'll withdraw from all the areas that ultimately they'll have to withdraw from if you're going to have a viable solution. So I think I don't think it's a viable solution. I don't think it's in Israel's interest to send the message that it's withdrawing in the face of Palestinian violence, and I don't think it's in the Palestinians' interest to be left on the other side of the wall. Ultimately, this is going to have to be resolved by both sides.
So questions together about what can be imposed. Mike's calling from Spring Green, Wisconsin. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
You know, Tom, I built up quite a head of steam here. I had to actually get out of my car when Isaiah said the words, the final solution.
Yeah.
How amazing was that statement? You know, I'm sick to death of this, Tom, because as far as I'm concerned, not a square foot of that land inside that fence is ever going to go back to the Palestinians, and I think that's abhorrent. I think Jack Beatty got it right. I think the caller Lee got it right. I got three sons, and I don't want to end up having them over in the Middle East defending Israel when they behave like this. And my final statement is, we're going to see Ariel Sharon. We should just get out of the way and let the Israeli people finally figure out that Ariel Sharon is going to turn Israel into a big glass tray, because bombs and missiles can go over that fence, gentlemen. I don't care what kind of a fence you make. Someday Israel will be just a big sheet of glass because of this kind of behavior.
Because you don't see it heading toward peace that can be sustained. And I guess, yes, missiles can go over a wall. Mike, drive safely. And it was a sad turn of phrase. But Dory Gold, you hear the fundamental doubt that a wall, a fortress, can work. What do you think?
Well, first of all, this word fortress, Conor Cruz O'Brien might have used it. He's a great writer. I appreciate him, but I wouldn't use this kind of term. I would think we're talking again about conflict management. We're talking about a way of cooling down the conflict. Now, in terms of what the wall does and what it doesn't do, it's clear that you can shoot a mortar over a wall. They have Qassam rockets on the Palestinian side in Gaza. That can also shoot over a wall, but we have to look at what the results are. The suicide bomber who walks across from Qalqilya into Kfar Saba can kill 30 people at a time. The Qassam rockets, the mortars, no matter how bad they've been, have not created those kind of losses. A Palestinian sitting on a hill in the West Bank, which is very close to Ben Gurion International Airport, can bring down a jumbo jet with an SA-7 shoulder-fired missile.
Dory Gold, with that,
those are the kind of things we can prevent.
We are out of time. I hear Mike worried about even bigger bombs. That for another day. Dory Gold, we're so grateful to you for staying up so late in Jerusalem to join us. Thanks very much for being with us. Dory Gold is advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, and Robert Malley in Washington. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Robert Malley, Middle East Program Director for the International Crisis Group. Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being on board.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, South African novelist J.M. Coetzee wins the 2003 Nobel Prize for Literature. This is On Point. The 2003 Nobel Prize for Literature was awarded today to the acclaimed South African novelist J. M. Coetzee. He is South Africa's second winner of the Nobel for Literature, following Nadine Gordimer, who took the prize in 1991. Known for his spare, often bleak prose, Coetzee, a white South African, has been one of the country's most probing writers on injustice and upheaval during and after apartheid. He was the first writer to win Britain's coveted Booker Prize twice, first for his novel The Life and Times of Michael Kay in 1983, and later for Disgrace in 1999, a book that grapples with South Africa's new, often violent, racial complexity. We end tonight with an excerpt from Disgrace. In this scene, the book's main character, David Lurie, and his daughter, Lucy, are viciously attacked, shaking Lurie's belief in the viability of the new South Africa.
So it has come, the day of testing, without warning. Without fanfare, it is here, and he is in the middle of it. In his chest, his heart hammers so hard that it, too, in its dumb way, must know. How will they stand up to the testing, he and his heart? His child is in the hands of strangers. In a minute, in an hour, it will be too late. Whatever is happening to her will be set in stone, will belong to the past. But now, it is not too late. Now he must do something. Though he strains to hear, he can make out no sound from the house. Yet if his child were calling, however mutely, surely he would hear. He batters the door. Lucy, Lucy, speak to me. The door opens, knocking him off balance. Before him stands the second man, the shorter one, holding an empty 1-liter bottle by the neck. The keys, says the man. No. The man gives him a push. He stumbles back, sits down heavily. The man raises the bottle. His face is placid, without a trace of anger. It's merely a job he's doing, getting someone to hand over an article. If it entails hitting him with a bottle, he will hit him. Hit him as many times as is necessary. If necessary, break the bottle, too. Take them, he says. Take everything. Just leave my daughter alone. Without a word, the man takes the keys, locks him in again. He shivers. A dangerous trio. Why did he not recognize it in time? But they're not harming him, not yet. Is it possible that what the house has to offer will be enough for them? Is it possible they will leave Lucy unharmed, too? From behind the house comes the sound of voices. The barking of dogs grows louder again, more excited. He stands on the toilet seat and peers through the bars of the window. Carrying Lucy's rifle and a bulging garbage bag, the second man is just disappearing around the corner of the house. A car door slams. He recognizes the sound. His car. The man reappears empty-handed. For a moment, the two of them look straight into each other's eyes. "Hi," says the man, and smiles grimly, and calls out some words. There's a burst of laughter. A moment later, the boy joins him, and they stand beneath the window, inspecting their prisoner, discussing his fate. He speaks Italian. He speaks French. But Italian and French will not save him here in darkest Africa. He is helpless. An Aunt Sally. A figure from a cartoon. A missionary in cassock and topi, waiting with clasped hands and upcast eyes while the savages jaw away in their own lingo, preparatory to plunging him into their boiling cauldron. Mission work. What is it left behind? That huge enterprise of upliftment. Nothing that he can see.
An excerpt from J.M. Coetzee's 1999 novel Disgrace, read by On Point producer Chris O'Connor. Today, J.M. Coetzee was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.